Are we facing 1970s style like inflation? Is a global economy drowning in debt? And is this expansion about to fall flat on its face? Answer those questions and more on today's special edition of the show, where I'm joined by Dr. Lacey Hunt of Hoisington Investment Management, a person who is one of the foremost experts on monetary policy, the bond market, and how that translates into the broad economy. Dr. Hunt, thank you for joining me today.
My pleasure. Great to be with you.
So Lacey, for some of my fans know who you are, but many don't. Can you share with us a little bit about who you are and what you do at Hoisington?
Well, I'm the chief economist and macroeconomist by training. I earned my PhD at Temple University 52 years ago, went into the Federal Reserve when William McChesney Martin was chairman. When I left, Arthur Burns was chairman. And when I left the Dallas Fed to go to Chase Econometrics to build a large-scale econometric model of the financial markets, David Rockefeller was running Chase Manhattan. So I've been around for a long time, and I was in the HSBC organization as their chief economist for 15 years, and I've been with Van Hoisington now 26 years.
So you've seen quite a bit over the time, and your expertise is in the bond market.
That is correct. One of my professors said to me, Lacey, what do you want to do with your macroeconomics? And I said, well, I thought I'd go into the Fed. He said, I think that's a great thing to do. It'll extend your theoretical knowledge. And he said, do you have an idea of where you'll concentrate your emphasis? And my professor, Nat Jackendoff, who was chairman of the finance department and supervised my dissertation, said, well, I think you'll be better off if you go and specialize in the fixed income markets, because there the economic relationships are much better than they are in the stock market. And I've come to believe the stock market's a very poor economic indicator. I basically have to ignore it to get the bond market correctly. So he suggested that, and that's where I concentrated, and I've been pleased with that decision.
Well, we're very fortunate to have you with us today, and I want to start out our conversation with kind of expectations of what's going on. And I hear from so many people that we're sitting on the bottom of a replay of the 1970s, where we're going to see just out of control inflation, followed by a secular, probably 40-year rise in interest rates. And as we go through your slides, I kind of want to get your initial reaction, you know, because I'm sure I'm not the only one who's hearing that. I'm sure you are too. Kind of what are your initial thoughts on that?
Well, in the 1970s, the economy was structurally a lot different than it is today. We were very lightly indebted. The marginal revenue product of debt in the 1970s was somewhere between 60 cents and 75 cents. It was relatively flat during that time period. Let's go back to the chart before that. And you can notice, for example, this is a series of the marginal revenue product of debt going back to 1870 for total debt and for non-financial debt since 45. Notice how flat it is across the 70s there. In fact, it's very flat from the early 50s to the early 80s. And the reason that it remained flat is that debt as a level of GDP was relatively constant. We were lightly indebted. And as a consequence, the velocity of money was stable. And that's also the time period in which the Nobel laureate Milton Friedman was doing the bulk of his academic research. And everyone is familiar with his great statement, inflation is always and everywhere a monetary phenomenon, in which he did say, but in his theoretical structure, he makes it clear that that is based on the empirical assessment that the velocity of money is stable, and which it was for nearly 30 years. And in the 1970s, there were wiggles, but velocity was basically mean reverting. If you get to it there, there it is. You can see it there in the 70s. And so there was a 10% increase in the money supply for the decade, and nominal GDP increased 10%.
Yeah, so let's on this, on your slide here, and I apologize, I didn't mean to cut you off. I want to just frame what we're looking at here for those who don't understand. What this means is when the government borrows money, how much growth are they getting out of every dollar they're borrowing? Is that correct?
That is correct, yeah. And what you're basically seeing is the, in this, the marginal revenue product is able to tell you whether in fact you're triggering the law of diminishing returns. The law of diminishing returns says that if you begin to overuse a factor of production, initially the GDP will rise, economic output will rise. But if you persist in overusing that factor, then the GDP increases level out. So you have increasing returns, flat returns, and then if you still overuse the factor of production, such as debt capital, you get diminishing returns. And that chart is illustrative of the fact that the causal element that's in control of these two variables is the law of diminishing returns. There are many other factors that influence velocity, but this is the dominant one.
So as what we're seeing here is the government debt is crowding out the private sector. Is that the issue, that there's just too much government
debt? It's
just
overuse. It's overuse. There, if you throw more labor into the production function, initially output will rise, and then it'll flatten out and decline. It's relying upon the validity of the production function, which is one of the most fundamental concepts in economics. You have to use the factors of production in proportionality. And if you do not, then you get the result that we're getting today.
So when we hear all these people talk about, you know, that if we get a $2 or $3 trillion or whatever this big number of stimulus, that it's going to be really inflationary, and maybe from a supply chain, but let's focus, I think, maybe more on the bond market, because the broad view is interest rates must go up. They can only go up. And when we get this big infrastructure bill, that seems to be a foregone conclusion that interest rates are literally going to go straight up. But what your data shows is that that necessarily isn't true, because what we're going to get out of whatever this infrastructure bill is going to be isn't as much as the headline number.
Mm-hmm. It's not just my research. I'm going to show you some serious academic research done since 2009 that indicates that the government government debt multiplier is negative. When I left Temple University in 1969, I believed that if you borrowed a dollar to undertake some type of federal activity, that you would boost private GDP by $4 to $5 more, and the total multiplier would be 4 or 5. I think today the best evidence is that the government multiplier is negative. In other words, for every dollar of borrowed funds at the federal level, at the end of the day, at the end of 3 years, you reduce private activity by about $1.30. So the multiplier is negative. Doesn't mean that debt was not effective at some point. In other words, when you're very lightly indebted, there is a beneficial impact. But as you start going up the debt chain, its overuse makes it ineffectual. And that's where we are. In fact, I'm going to show you research that confirms that in just a minute. Not mine, but other folks' research.
So the way I like to look at this, Lacey, is I like to think of, let's say we'll take a young couple, we'll make them both professionals, they've got, you know, good jobs, they're just starting out, and they buy their first home and they don't have a lot of debt. So what do? They buy cars, they buy furniture, they go, you know, they spend a lot of money, and that creates a lot of growth. But as that debt builds up, all of a sudden they find out that their ability to borrow and get growth out of from their income is limited. And I see that same relationship here with the economy, is we just can't get growth out of more borrowing.
No, that it, the economy basically grinds down. There's an initial benefit, then there's a period in which there's no benefit, but it's not negative. And then, what people have trouble with, Steve, and I know you don't, is that they think that more should be more, because that's the way it is in accounting. But economics is not accounting. If I were a physicist and I told you that you're going to have to deal with a nonlinear relationship, you wouldn't like it, because you might not be able to conceptualize it, but you would accept it because you know that we get these parabolic functions and colliding bodies can change the trajectory of the path and so forth and so on. But the law of diminishing returns is nonlinear, and I'm going to show you research that confirms that too.
Okay. Do we have a slide on that I can go to?
Yes. Well, we have some summaries of some research. Go over two more pages.
Here.
You see, there's some summaries. I'm going to cite three of those studies on those two pages that give you this evidence. Very serious research. The first one there, for example, is done by two Swedish economists, Henriksson and Berg. They're published in an American Economic Review, American Economic Association publication, serious peer-reviewed. And they're, of course, not being in the United States, they're outside of the political debate here. And they find that as the share of government rises, you depress economic activity. And that means the multiplier is not only negative, it will become more negative over time. But there's other serious research. For example, look at line number four. This is a study published in the Journal of Monetary Economics, serious. Economists at the London School of Economics, the Wharton School, and the University of Maryland. And they find that in highly indebted economies with a government debt to GDP exceeding 60%, that this results in a negative multiplier. And then if you go to the next page, look at line number eight. This was actually the first econometric study that suggested to me that what the causal relationship is diminishing returns. This research was published by the European Central Bank. The two lead writers, Christina Cecerita, is director of the Fiscal Affairs Division of the ECB, and Dr. Philip Rother is chief economist of the European Economic Commission. And notice their words there. They show that there is a nonlinear relationship, and that this deleterious effect on economic activity begins somewhere between 70 and 80%. So the studies have different thresholds, but nearly all of them are of the view that above 90% gross government debt to GDP, that the effect becomes very deleterious. And the studies uniformly use gross government debt, and they're looking at real per capita GDP, which is the correct way to do it, and gross, because all of these countries in Europe, in the United States, and Japan, we have a tremendous amount of unfunded liabilities in the social program. So if you use net, you're understating the debt even more significantly. So the studies all use gross government debt. They show that there is a beneficial effect in the beginning, wears out, and then it turns negative. It's a nonlinear relationship. And the one that seems to me, the only one that I can think of, is the law of diminishing returns.
So what I find interesting about your research and the research of these other experts is the notion that more government debt will yield a higher, will lead to, I just didn't mean to say yield, will lead to higher interest rates is actually not true at all. In fact, the more government debt we have, the lower rates need to go. Is that correct?
That is correct. In other words, and if we know over the very short run, if the government issues more debt, hold everything ceteris paribus unchanged, all other things being equal, there's an increase. But we live in a dynamic world. It's characterized by the Latin phrase mutatis mutandis, which means all things are changing together. And so initially, when you undertake a debt-financed operation, you do get a benefit, but it's very brief. It lasts maybe a quarter, a little bit longer. The shovel-ready projects of 2009 gave us a 1 to 2 quarter benefit. The debt-financed tax cuts of 2018. I know you were active then. Second quarter of 2018, great quarter. Third quarter wasn't quite as good. The growth rate tailed off all the way through 2019, even though the Fed was cutting interest rates. And we were decelerating pretty hard when the pandemic hit. And that's just the nature of it. There is a benefit as a short-run impact, raises interest rates and inflation during that. But then the debt becomes a drain. And it pulls interest rates ever lower.
Now, is this because the debt is not creating, as you point out, a cash flow? And if you could frame that kind of, was the debt actually creating cash flow in the 70s, which is why we saw
it? It was creating it at a constant rate. In other words, we were taking on a dollar of debt and we were generating approximately 70 cents. It's constant. It was a neutral effect. In other words, we always have some non-productive. But there was no deviation away from what we had normally done. And I think that's the critical factor.
So the way I like to look at this, for those who are kind of struggling perhaps with what we're talking about, is let's say that I go out and I purchase a rental property. And, you know, I clean it up.
Could I just add one other point before you try to take your question?
Sure.
The late Hyman Minsky, originated the term Ponzi finance. And he's basically drawing upon the original work of Ergen, Bob Bawerk, and Irving Fisher, who gave us the definitions of debt. And what Minsky said is that if you take on debt and it cannot conceivably generate an income stream to repay principal and interest, then you've created Ponzi finance. Now, Minsky believed that Ponzi finance led to economic instability, market instability. Now, we haven't seen that except for brief episodes, but what we have seen is that there is a more insidious effect, that by taking on the debt, we're undermining the growth of the standard of living. Let's look at chart one, because it to my way of thinking, is the most critical piece of evidence, which is consistent with the academic research and also with the law of diminishing returns. The blue line is an extrapolation of the growth in real per capita GDP from 1870 to 2000. And the reason 1870 is that's where the best data starts. We have data before, but there are problems, too many problems for me to assume that I can rely on it. So the historic rate of growth was 2.2% per annum. So notice the blue line is growing at 2.2% per annum. The black line is the actual rate of growth in real, the actual level of real GDP in real per capita terms. And notice in the fourth quarter of 2019, before the pandemic hit, where the red dot is, we are 17% below. In other words, the deviation from the trend line is getting greater and greater. And after the pandemic hit in the second quarter of this year, we're at 58,500 approximately. If we'd stayed on the blue line, we'd be almost 26% higher today.
Yeah, that's incredible.
To me, very compelling. And 2000, by 2000, clearly the academic studies and other points of evidence, which I'll show you, suggest that debt was there, clearly beginning to have this deleterious impact. And what do we do? When we actually chart it out, we see that the deviation from trend line is getting deeper and deeper.
So the way I want to look at this is, to help those who don't understand, is we'll come back to my example of I'm going to go buy a rental property to rent it out. And we'll assume that I take a mortgage and that I'm able to actually rent it out at a higher rate than all my mortgage, taxes, and all my other expenses. That's a productive use of debt.
Absolutely.
But let's say that I have negative cash flow because I bought too high or can't get the rent. Now I have unproductive debt because I'm actually losing money. And
yes,
so if my solution to my money losing problem is to go get more rental properties that have negative cash flow, thinking that if I just have more of them, that somehow the situation gets better, it actually doesn't get better. It actually gets worse. Yeah. And that's what we're seeing here in the broad economy, is we're borrowing more and more money. We're not getting anything out. We're getting less out of it. And it's leading to a massive amount of economic underperformance.
That's correct. It's very slow. It's very insidious. Maybe at some point in time, Minsky will be right. The Ponzi finance will lead to instability. I don't know. But we do know that there is this continuing erosion. We have a lot of instances historically of highly over-indebted economies. We have four great empires: the Mesopotamian, the Roman, the Bourbons of France, the British Empire, that basically disintegrated under the weight of too much debt. Britain survived at the end of World War II, but it was so weak that it could not refinance the outstanding debt levels. Therefore, it couldn't maintain holding all of its empire. Remember what Winston Churchill said about the sun in the British Empire. Well, it no longer applies. Britain stayed. So we have a lot of cases. And in fact, David Hume, who was Adam Smith's mentor, and my professor Ingrid Reima, said that without the Enlightenment, without David Hume, we couldn't have had the Enlightenment. Hume was a tremendous thinker, probably one of the greatest of mankind. He wrote a paper in 1752 called Of Public Credit. And he said that when a state has mortgaged all of its future revenue, the state lapses into tranquility, languor, and impotence. So you just grind down. And that's consistent with what Neil Ferguson has shown, Scent of Money, some other more serious papers, as well as a lot of others. It's a slow grind down. And what we're basically saying here, you and I know examples of households that have disintegrated, had great problems because of over, and we know that of businesses, small and large. We know that of state and local governments. We know it of banana republics. And basically what we're saying is there is no exemption for the large scale industrial country. When you're the reserve currency of the world, you have certain assets that others don't have. And it allows you to string the process out, and you can prevent the collapse, but you cannot prevent the erosion and the growth in the standard of living.
So does that mean if we continue down this path, which it appears for now that we will, and based on what we can look behind us, we can assume that we will, is it possible we could see a failure of our monetary system from this? Or is it more just we would, the prosperity of the United States would be at such a low level, it wouldn't break the system, but it just maybe look like a different country?
Well, currently, when the United States left the gold standard in 1933, the Federal Reserve Act had to be rewritten. And the principal author of the Federal Reserve Act was Carter Glass of Virginia, Senator Glass. He also wrote Glass-Steagall. Many people perhaps know that name. And he went to Irving Fisher at Yale and Charles Whittlesey at Wharton. And he said, now we want to give the Federal Reserve great power, but we don't want them to become a banana republic. So they made the Fed lender of last resort, not spender of last resort. And so the Fed's liabilities are not medium of exchange. People don't grasp that. They're not a medium of exchange. They're not a store of value, and they can't serve as a unit of account accordingly. So the Fed can facilitate the increase in debt, but it's not the spender of last resort. Now, there are a lot of people that are saying, well, let's make the Fed's liabilities legal tender, medium of exchange. That would then destroy the system. You would then get hyperinflation. As long as we have the current system and you take on more and more debt, you're just going to grind down. If you modify the system to coordinate monetary and fiscal policy more, you'll go into the inflationary option. And if we move... We're moving the role of government, making it larger all the time. And what the historical record shows that as you do this, you increase the government share of economic activity and you reduce the private share. But the government share, as I showed you, has a negative multiplier. Private share has a positive multiplier. So if you move toward command and control, you give the government a bigger share, reduce the private share, and that also grinds the growth rate down. So you do have a second mechanism that comes into play. And we've seen that operative. And look at the massive coordination that we've seen in Europe and Japan. Their growth is greatly underperforming ours. We could put those two charts up if you want to.
Yeah, I think is this the first one?
Let's look at the first one there. This is the marginal return from debt, total debt. U.S. is the green line. The orange line is Europe. And the black line is Japan. And notice that they have consistently underperformed us. Each dollar of total debt is generating 25 cents of GDP in the U.S. It's 20 in Europe and 15 in Japan. So let's look at how this has affected economic activity. What we did here is on the left-hand axis, we took the ratio of real per capita GDP in 2010 U.S. dollars in the U.S. relative to Japan. So in 1995, our real per capita GDP was actually 7% lower than Japan. I mean, Japan was a very prosperous country in the 1980s. Part of the prosperity was on a false premise because they were taking on massive amounts of debt. And in 1995, we were 23% larger than Europe in real per capita terms. You have to do this in per capita terms because we all have different population levels. And so look at the numbers now. Against Japan, we are now 13% larger. We've had a swing of 20 percentage points in a little bit more than 25 years. It's almost a percentage point a year. And we're now 38% larger than Europe. So what is important is that we can see that as the U.S. has become more indebted, our growth rate has fallen further below our trend line, and Europe and Japan are below us, and they're more indebted. To me, the numbers fit together.
And so this is really interesting because I think the key thing that I really want to impart on those who are watching is the government really is actually crowding out the private sector. So when people ask me, it says, well, what could you do? Not that I would ever be in a position to do such a thing, but if what could we do to create more growth, to bring things back and bring inflation up? And my answer is generally about the same. It's the government needs to spend less, perhaps even run a surplus, bring the debt level down, and return the economy to the private sector, which is where you get the money growth from and you get everything else that you want.
That's exactly correct. And let's look go back to those studies, because this has already been researched by one very capable. Let's go back to the prior page. Okay, now look at line number 16. You might highlight that. One of our leading researchers in the effect of debt is McKinsey Global Institute. They're the think tank of McKinsey. And in the 2010 paper, they looked at these 24 advanced economies in the time period between 1900 and 2008. And they traced the buildup of debt, the debt bubble peak, and then how it was resolved. And now these were all advanced economies. They were not, banana republics. And McKinsey concluded that in all 24 cases, it required austerity. And they defined austerity just the way you did, Steve, as a sustained rise in net national savings. So here is the problem. To go toward austerity over the short run, fiscal policy would have a negative impact on economic activity. It would be beneficial in the long run. But because we have a political democracy and so forth, we don't have the will. There's no practical way to do it. And so we keep trying to solve an indebtedness problem by taking on more debt. Now, in those 24 cases, you have that was resolved in several ways. In several of the cases, the debt just burned out. In other words, the private sector handled it. We had a massive buildup of debt in the 1860s and 1870s. The panic year was 1873. It was taking on railroad debt, the industries that financed the railroads. We were on the gold standard. We did not have a central bank. So there was no heroic response. That's the term that the late MIT economist Charles Kindleberger uses. And so we just ground through the next two decades. But after two decades, the problem had been resolved. The marketplace handled it. And then we had relatively strong growth. We had cyclical episodes and so forth, and we had some deflation, but it was handled. World War II was another example of austerity. People say, well, didn't we benefit from all the military expenditures and the exports? Yes, we did. We were selling to our allies who were war zones. However, we had mandatory rationing. You couldn't buy everything you wanted. We had ration cards. And so we had a government deficit of 14% of GDP, but we had private saving of 26% of GDP. And so we had debt national saving of 10 to 14%, and we paid off all the debts of the 1920s and 1930s. And we were very lightly indebted. We were able to have that sustained period of economic growth. In the 60s, 70s, we had cyclical episodes, but nothing structural. The British Empire at the end of World War II, the austerity was imposed upon them by their lenders. And the British, for example, had to continue wartime rationing all the way to 1956. very difficult. But there's no mechanism to enforce that today. The only path seems to be to try to hope that we can take on more debt and it somehow kickstart the economy. Let me just give you one of the basic relationships in economics. And it holds in the monetary school, the Keynesian school, and the Austrian school. And it says that physical investment must equal saving out of income. That you can't have physical investment with stuff the Fed does. The Fed can facilitate the flows, but you have to have someone push back from the dinner table so you have the resources to put in. So from 1929 through the second quarter, net national investment, real investment, not financial, as a percent of net national income was 6.3. It's currently it's 2%. It's been trending down. It's been very weak. So in the last couple of quarters, you've had a government deficit of 14% to 10% of GDP. You've had private saving, but it only gets you back up to 2% net national. That includes the farm. Well, 2% is one third that we've had historically. So if you take on another $3 trillion program or $2 trillion program, what it means is you're going to reduce net national saving back towards zero. There's no benefit from this infrastructure package. And if it's all tilted towards social income maintenance and the like, there's not any reasonable prospect that can generate an income stream. It may be politically popular, may be politically necessary, but the economy will not benefit from it, my view. And I'm not making this as a political statement. I'm in the fixed income business, and I'm just trying to execute a fiduciary responsibility for our clients. And that's been the pattern in every major economy that has gone the high debt road. You get initial benefit, the benefit then wears out, and then it turns negative. And we're in the negative diminishing returns phase.
We're seeing that now with the fiscal stimulus that's kind of gone away. We're seeing the economy start to slow down. We just saw the Chicago Fed National Activity Index. We're seeing interest rates trend lower. And so it's interesting, Lacey, because people say, well, you know, because I'm very much a bond bull. I believe interest rates are going lower. I believe, you know, the structural issues of the economy are going to lead to lower rates. But people say, man, if they have this $3 trillion, I said, make it $30 trillion. It doesn't matter, because whatever the initial, you know, inflationary effects are, it's going to be immediately reversed by just this new weight of debt, this highly unproductive debt.
And that's where we are. We're going to keep, you know, the great Sir Isaac Newton gave us the theory of gravity, laws of gravity, which held until Einstein's theory of relativity, believed that you could mix lead, mercury, and get gold. And so he started with very small quantities of each. And he went to larger and larger quantities, thinking that if he just had a bigger mix, that the result would change. But the only thing that happened is that he killed himself through lead and mercury poisoning. And if it doesn't work at a small level, it's not going to work at a large. That you have to identify. Modern monetary theory, in my opinion, has already been tested and failed. Mm-hmm. We can see the deleterious effects of debt. What they would do is they would just do more of it, but the results are already known to us, in my opinion. And part of it is diminishing returns, and the other part of it is that as you move toward a greater government share of economic activity, you've got problems. And another part of the element is that you have to have saving out of income, saving from private, government, and foreign to equal your investment. And in the current environment, the government dissaving is so large that there's no prospect of having net national saving to any significant degree, nearly close to what we've normally had.
Right. And all you're saying is that if I want to go out and buy a car, I could go finance it. But if I save money, that savings that I'm using, whether it's to pay cash or as a down payment, which it's highly irrelevant, is that savings is future spending. And we just don't have the savings because the government is trying to backfill that with fiscal that's clearly just falling right through the bucket. I mean, the bucket's so full of holes that it's just not holding. And then all of this, what we're doing is just adding on more unproductive debt.
That's exactly right. You said it better than I did.
So one thing that when I first saw your research many years ago that really blew me away, and I think speaks to the ineffectiveness of monetary policy and how it has negative impacts, is a money multiplier. And I was wondering if you could kind of take us through this and some of the slides on the money supply and the velocity of money, because you might find this interesting, Lacey, but I've had people tell me recently that the velocity of money is absolutely meaningless.
Well, it's not. It's very meaningful. First of all, we've shown our own correlation studies, which shows that there's a very high correlation between the marginal revenue product of debt and the velocity of money, and also the loan to deposit ratio, both very highly correlated. So we had this long period of stable velocity. Then we deregulated the banking system in the early 80s. We had a great deal of financial innovation leveraged up, and initially velocity rose. That's increasing returns. And then we had a relatively flat period, and it's been trending lower. And in my view, it will continue trending lower. Let's go back and look at the money multipliers. The money multiplier is the relationship between the monetary base, which the Fed largely controls, and M2. They do not control the money multiplier. In the textbooks, they teach that if you have a 10% reserve requirement, and you add a dollar of reserves, that'll increase the money supply tenfold, the binomial theorem. Well, as you can see, when the reserve requirement was 10%, the money multiplier was never 10. It's been higher, it's been lower. But as we become more indebted, the money multiplier has dropped. Now, no, put your cursor there on last year. The multiplier shot up because the Fed eliminated reserve requirements. There are no more reserve requirements. But that benefit is wearing off, and the money multiplier is now declining. And so let's go to the next chart. What that means is that in spite of last year's huge increase in the monetary base and in the money supply, it's now being reversed. Look at the 3-month rate of growth. It's in the inset. There is a group in London called Macro Strategy, which does a weekly tracking of M2. The Fed no longer publishes M2 weekly, but from the sources that are available, and they're not complete. They're saying in the latest 3 months ending mid-October that M2 growth is down to 5.9. Well, what's doing that is the money multiplier is falling. And the money multiplier falls when the risk premium rises, which is a sign of over-indebtedness. Now, look at the formula. Put your cursor on the formula. The Fed is saying that they're going to reduce their purchases by $15 billion a month. Whether they do that or not, no one knows, but they're presumably going to announce that next week. So if you take that and convert that equation to first difference, what that means is that the rate of growth in the base is going to start slowing. The multiplier is going to continue falling, in my view. which means that money supply is not stopping at 5.9, where macro strategy says it is now. It's going to decelerate. And the velocity of money is going to continue declining. Will it decline every quarter? No, let's go back and look at the chart for velocity. You've had some intermittent upturns because there are other factors at work there. But this is a very, very powerful downtrend. And what will happen is that the marginal revenue product will continue declining. So let's go on and look at the international comparisons. So the U.S. is the reserves currency, world currency, reserve currency, and money is fungible. So when we grow faster, we tend to lift. So look where we were there in the early part of the year on the green line. Well, that was last year. So we pulled everybody up with us, and look at that. Look back at March on the green line, Steve. Go to March of 21, I'm sorry.
Oh, 21, okay, here.
So at that point in time, we were almost at a three-month growth rate of 20%, and we're now coming down to 5.9, and we're headed lower. And we think, not surprisingly, the growth is slowing in Europe, Japan, and China. And let's look at the velocity in each of these countries, because money supply by itself doesn't mean anything. It's one input, velocity is an equal partner. So the U.S. is not as indebted as Europe. So Europe's velocity is lower. Money's not even turning over one time per year in Europe. And in Japan and China, it's only turning over about a half time per year. So we're the least indebted. We're underperforming. Europe and Japan are underperforming us, and the velocity of money is weaker. So we're all in basically the same boat. Monetary policy is essentially becoming what I call asymmetric. When the Fed wants to stimulate the economy, even when they do it in massive size, they only get a very limited benefit. They can still tighten, and their tools work. But as you become more indebted, you press the multiplier down, and this is a force that's basically pushing your rate structure toward the zero bound. That's where we are. So let's go on to the next page. Look at some relationships. These are theoretical, but they're worth understanding. And this chart helps to explain why this is not the 1970s. This and the next chart explain why we're not in a replay of the 70s. So this is your basic general equilibrium approach to macroeconomic analysis. And so the aggregate supply curve, labeled AS0, is upward sloping. All supply curves are upward sloping. In other words, if you offer a producer a higher price, he's going to sell more. Notice that the price level is on the vertical axis. Let's go over to the vertical axis. And so when you get a supply side disruption, the aggregate supply curve shifts inward. Now the aggregate demand curve, AD0, is sloping downward. So when you have a supply side disruption, that raises the price level from P0 to P1. Notice if P1 is further from the origin. Go down to the origin. It's at zero. So when you get a supply side disruption, you get higher prices, but go to the horizontal axis and notice what happens to real GDP. Go down to the horizontal axis. You get a decline in real GDP. That's the technical term for that is a supply side recession. Now, when you get a supply side disruption, so you get higher prices, you get lower real GDP, but go to the little formula to the right of the page, go to the second formula, the output gap. The output gap is potential less real GDP. So when you have a supply side disruption, you increase the output gap. It's called a deflationary gap, which then serves to undermine economic performance going forward. Now, let's go to the last of these charts. It's last page, next page. And let's look at the title. In the 1970s, the aggregate demand curve shifted outward as M2 growth accelerated and velocity was stable, allowing price increases to spiral. Okay, so let's go through the steps. So start on AS0. We had multiple supply side disruptions, almost all in the energy sector. So the aggregate supply curve shifts inward. But in the 1970, the Burns Fed and later the Miller Fed increased money supply growth. And what that did is it brought the aggregate demand curve back from AD0 to AD1. And so the price level then moved not from just P0 to P1, but all the way up to P2. But your GDP doesn't really, all it does is get back to where it was. Now, why does the aggregate demand curve shift? Well, let's go to the formulas there to the right. Let's look at the top line. Aggregate demand equals GDP, but GDP is also money and velocity. By algebraic substitution, the aggregate demand curve is money times velocity. And in the 1970s, money supply growth was accelerating, velocity was stable, and that allowed the aggregate demand curve to shift upward. What I believe is that the Fed has already engineering, or the market forces are engineering a slowdown in money growth because of the money multiplier. The Fed is now going to strengthen the deceleration by tapering. The multiplier will keep dropping and the aggregate demand curve will not shift outward. It will actually hold its own or shift inward further. This is not the 19th. There are other problems. So if you want to just skip the theoretical analysis, in the 1970s, we were lightly indebted. As a result of that, the velocity of money was stable. Money supply growth accelerated. The demographics were strong. The average age in the United States was 29 years. And then we're now 39. The world is even older, and the demographics are even worse. The whole set of conditions are different, really. It's very important when you're doing economic analysis to go through all of what are known as the initial conditions. And they're just different.
So what I look at, Lacey, is the money supply, which has been heavily boosted due to fiscal stimulus. Obviously, we know that's going away. And as you mentioned, the research, the most current data shows it's decelerating, which I agree that it's going to decelerate even further. And then the velocity, even if the velocity stays constant at this low level, which I would also agree that's likely to continue to head lower, what we're going to see is these higher prices get rejected. And this is something a ton of people take issue with me, is that I like to tell them that you can get higher prices, you can sustain higher prices, but if the money supply isn't growing fast enough, if I'm not getting an increase in wages or have some form where I have more money to afford higher prices, they ultimately get rejected and lead to lower prices. Is that true?
That's very valid. And it's also important to look at what stage of the business cycle you are. And so we're in an early stage expansion. We had a deep recession, as you saw. We came much further away from trend as a result of the pandemic. In early stage expansions, economies need three things to happen. They need inflation to come down. And that's why inflation is a lagging indicator. If inflation doesn't come down, then in inflation, prices rise faster than wages. And then that undermines real wage growth. In addition, if inflation doesn't come down, then interest rates don't come down. And this year we've had a bit of a backup in interest rates. And since we've been very heavily indebted from the start of the recession to the low point in inflation and interest rates, the lags have been 3, 4, 5 years. They need to decline. They're not just observed by the National Bureau of Economic Research as being lagging indicators. There's a theoretical reason. And the other reason that you need lower inflation is so that people will not buy as many foreign goods. If the domestic inflation rate moves higher, then we import more goods. Now, fortunately for us, we're trying to buy the foreign goods, but we've got these supply side disruptions. But once the supply side disruptions end, then the current account deficit is going to get worse. In other words, early stage expansions experience falling inflation, rising real income, and an improving trade sector and improving interest sensitive sector. You don't get that, then the economy doesn't gain traction. So you're exactly right, Steve.
Yeah, I've been mentioning that high oil right now, and I know that, I mean, if you want to talk about just the energy sector, we can skip it if that's okay. But these, you look at high energy prices, you look at high food prices, you look at the things that people have to spend money, and we're expecting rents to go up, is all that does is take away from discretionary spending. And then, as you mentioned, the ports are lined up with ships full of what I refer to as deflation. They're just waiting to bring these lower priced goods on shore. And you start to look at the consumer standpoint without fiscal stimulus, they've got less money, prices are higher. And it tells me that this early stage expansion, while it may pull out, the setup is not good for it historically.
No, the best we can do is stay positive, but we're going to fall further and further below the trend line. If it were several years ago, we had a rise in energy prices. At that point in time, there was a very strong increase in domestic drilling and production. And so the moderate and modest income households were hurt because the basic necessities rose. They spend a much higher proportion of their budget on that. And so that impaired their ability to spend. But the overall economy was benefiting from the high multiplier increase in drilling and production and so forth. Right now, however, the gain in drilling is very muted. It's not the elastic response that we've experienced over the last half decade because the energy producers don't know what the rules are going forward. And so the rig count, instead of being close to 2,000, is just barely above 500. And so the moderate and modest income households are being hurt as prices rise faster than wages, but the overall economy is not benefiting from a surge in production. And in fact, the energy sector is one of the biggest worries to me because it looks like our older fields, not just in the United States, but around the world, are decaying pretty rapidly. And that's a problem that we may have to contend with.
So one thing I want to ask you about is you mentioned the Fed in the 1970s was able to expand the money supply. Today, the Fed isn't. They really just don't seem to be able to do much with that. And it wasn't until we had this fiscal that we really saw the money supply just shoot higher. Could you tell me what did the Fed do differently in the 1970s versus now, and why? I guess I shouldn't ask you why the Fed isn't. Is it what could the Fed do today, perhaps, to get that same effect, or can they?
Well, okay. So what was happening is that to come out of the two recessions, the Fed had to bring interest rates down and boost money supply growth. And since we were very lightly indebted, the monetary policies brought us out of the 70 and 75 recessions. And Then almost immediately, the interest rates started rising. And the Federal Reserve didn't want that to happen for a variety of reasons, mainly political. I don't want to go into it, but they wanted to hold the interest rates down. So to, in a misguided approach to try to hold interest rates down, they accelerated money supply growth.
Okay. So and so the problem the Fed faces today is rates are just at zero and we have too much debt. I mean, they don't have the
so
same.
So they accelerated, it went into debt, and the velocity of money was stable. So the aggregate demand curve shifted outward. And so what did that do? That started putting upward pressure on interest rates. And then mistakenly again, they tried to address the rising interest rates by accelerating money supply growth. But in the current environment, money supply growth, it was very rapid last year, and we did have some inflation, but the money supply growth is decelerating very sharply. And with the tapering, in my view, it's going to decelerate even further. By the way, that little formula, M2 equals the monetary base times the money multiplier, was developed by the monetary economists Carl Brunner and Alan Meltzer. And that's been empirically vetted. It's in all of the major textbooks. And it's a controlling influence. The Fed can control the base. They cannot control the money multiplier. But what they're going to find is the money multiplier is going to do as much or more work than the tapering will do, in my view. Possibility.
So you don't think the taper, there's going to be any good outcomes from it? And whether or not they actually do or whether they get to the end of it, you don't see any positive outcome from that?
No. And I think that the record shows that when the Fed began tapering QE1, 2, and 3, except when the Fed was advertising they were going to do it, the long-term interest rates and inflation rate came down. Everyone's focused on, well, there's less buying, we've got a large budget deficit, we're going to get higher interest rates. But the sequence is that we're going to get lower money supply. Ironically, once the tapering occurs, this will drain as much or more money from the financial markets. You see, when the Fed pumps money in and velocity declines, the liquidity is trapped in the financial markets. This leads to a bidding up of financial asset prices, reduction in returns on financial assets. So if money supply growth comes down, it's quite possible, and we saw this in the aftermath of QE 1, 2, and 3, the liquidity comes most dominantly from the financial market. The real sector will be drained, but so will the financial markets.
Right. We saw the money supply growth slow here, kind of in the aftermath.
Well, notice what happens right at the first QE1, there's your peak there in 10 and 11. And you see it, the other programs had a diminished impact. They did lead to some acceleration, but basically the rate of growth in money was coming down. And if you go and look at the velocity page, because there was more debt, principally at the federal level, velocity kept declining. And that's why the expansion from the 2009 recession was the worst that we ever had. And people are aware of that. But what they're not aware of is, go back to chart one. We've really been underperforming now for more than two decades. It's not just that the post 2009 recession was the worst. We're now into two decades of significant underperformance. It's very insidious, but our people understand it. The birth rate's coming down. We have less marriages. We have fewer babies. We're tending to get older. So the demographics are responding. The outward signs are there. Go back to chart one, when you begin to fall further below the trend line, what happens is you exacerbate the differences between your highest and lowest income levels, which is not really that healthy longer term. The monetary and fiscal policies designed to help ordinary citizens actually benefits a very small segment of the economy. Has really nasty results, in my opinion.
Yeah, so it looks to me like the Fed's been kind of artificially holding this up with QE, even though QE is, the longer they do it, I think it's kind of like the debt too. It becomes less effective, even at the gargantuan amount of $120 billion a month. But as they pull that support, I think the big takeaway for people watching this isn't inflation. It's the likeliness that the economy is going to roll over or slow, and that interest rates are likely to head down. And in terms of inflation, we're more likely to see disinflation. And if things get bad, we could probably see what we saw during the great financial crisis, which is outright deflation again.
It's really part and parcel of diminishing returns, because monetary policy works for getting people more indebted. So they're really part and parcel of the same issue.
Well, Lacey, I really appreciate you taking your time this morning.
Nice to be with you. Great question, Steve. Keep up the good work.
You're such an inspiration to all of us who are really trying to understand how the system works, but more importantly, how it transmits out into the economy so we can make smarter investment decisions. And I just want to applaud your efforts in helping all of us. I know you don't have to do any of this, but you do it. And, you know, you're a hugely valuable resource for everyone.
Mighty kind of you to say that. Let's make sure that the Fed's liabilities are not made legal tender, though.
Well, I hope that doesn't happen. And for all the people rooting for that, I think they would be in for a shock at how bad that outcome would be.
It will be horrendous. Great to be with you, Steve.
Lacey, thanks again. I appreciate your time and look forward to perhaps a chat in the future.
Okay, all the best.
The content of this video is provided as educational information only and is not intended to provide investment or other advice. This material is not to be construed as recommendation or solicitation to buy or sell any security, financial product, instrument, or to participate in any particular trading strategy. This video was prepared by Steve Van Meter in personal capacity. The opinions expressed in this video are that of my own and do not reflect the view of Atlas Financial Advisors, Inc. or Steve Van Meter Financial.